So this is really bizarre, teaching a little class in a massive room, but that really doesn't feel very interactive. I usually like to be at a table with people, but ask questions. I don't know if I'll know the answers, but we can work through it or get back to it and see how it goes. So let's just jump right in. And so people gave this lecture in the last few years, and I stole a few of their slides and a little bit of their organizational concept. So hopefully I did them some justice, or they helped me out, however you want to think about it. So really, in the next hour, give or take, we want to talk about these three issues. Kind of fundamentally, what is genomic instability? What factors contribute to genome integrity, or lack of factors contribute to instability? Flip it around. And how do we identify indicators of genomic instability? And fortunately, when I started thinking about this last week, in last week's issue of Nature, there was a really, really good paper on the kind of genesis of pancreatic cancer at a molecular level and the contribution of instability to tumor genesis. And so I hope we can get through these first. I know we're going to get through these first three parts pretty quickly and talk about the paper a little bit. And I encourage, it's a nice paper that kind of integrates this whole idea of genetic instability in a very relevant model. One that people who work on solid tumors think about all the time. And so I'll try to just glance about what that model is, but it's something that you could think about kind of in the medium and long term also. So, cells do their level best, essentially, to maintain genome integrity. Because we all know that, instability or loss of chromosomes is essentially lethal almost all the time. It's the rare, essentially, time that having a defect in genome propagation is compatible with continued existence of the cell. So, in a kind of Darwinian sense, cells want to maybe have a little bit of change, but they want to continue to live. So, in order to maintain that integrity, they have very tightly coordinated replication of their DNA. They have damage sensing and repairs, which I think you might have heard about last week, some aspects of that. And they have the cell cycle checkpoints, which I looked at the notes and you did hear about last week. And all of these kind of restriction points pretty much represent tumor suppressors. And so if they're lost, they're tumorigenic. I you could use that kind of loose definition. So it's not all bad instability. As I was alluding to, it drives evolution, right? Some degree of change is good. It allows adaptation. And for, some specific developmental processes and for immune maturation, this kind of genomic instability is required. But frequently, we're in a cancer institute, in an oncology course, it's instability is detrimental. There are syndromes of premature aging, a variety of inherited diseases, and of course cancer that result from instability. And so we all know that cancer is kind of hyper-evolution, and that results in unrestrained growth and spread of the tumor mass. And kind of historically, or it's thought that it results from activation of pro-growth oncogenes and inactivation of tumor suppressors, like we were talking about, replication checkpoints or a variety of other tumor suppressors, which talked about earlier in your course. So this is the old-fashioned Hanahan and Weinberg model from I guess now 16 years ago, where they talked about the things that drive or allow cancer progression. And so, activation of oncogenes, loss of tumor suppressors, evading apoptosis, and I probably wouldn't have put IGF here, but I would have put something like, BCL2, replication potential, talking about telomerase, growth factors, nutrition, and then restraints on invasion. So that was the kind of classical model, and leading up to that model was the work of the Vogelstein lab, who was looking at what was happening in colorectal cancers, and they came up with this simple but now very well established model that you have normal colon, there's an initiating event that allows hyperplastic growth, and then there's this cascade of continuing events that lead through tumor development and kind of loss of growth control until you have some precipitating events which lead to a frank carcinoma that escapes the local site. So, of course, life isn't that simple. Even in the 90s, they knew that it wasn't that simple. And so here's that classic pathway again. But you can see that they soon figured out that there's this hypermethylator phenotype that adds a lot of mutation in here and continues to add mutation. And by the time you get a lot of replication errors and develop this frank cancer, you have this huge change in the genomic landscape and change in regulators of replication, cell cycle checkpoints and repair molecules all come together to give this fulminant phenotype of cancer. So the question is, how do you accumulate all of these, this huge mutational burden, this huge mutational load that seems to be necessary to move, from some dysplastic growth into a cancer? And for colon cancer, they were able to figure out that it was some combination of, or maybe even an isolated set of changes in the genome, whether it was chromosome instability, microsatellite instability, this CGP methylator phenotype, these CPG islands, that would cause, so this MSI causes insertional mutations, the SIN causes, big chromosomal changes, and the SIMP causes methylation of important effector genes, including oncogenes and tumor suppressors, but also some mismatch repair gene, particularly MLH1, which makes SIMP lead to an MSI-like phenotype and hypermutation again. And so that apparently is how you get to cancer. So then 5 years ago now, didn't seem like that long ago, Hanahan and Weiberg went back and went and looked at their, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 original indicators of cancer or drivers of cancer. And they added 4 more, energetics, immune avoidance, inflammation, and genome instability. And so let's move into, what's driving the cancers. So genetic selection really happens at the level of single cells. And so if a cell blows up its chromosome, it's going to die. If it makes some selected mutations to give it a growth advantage, it's going to continue to be able to proliferate. And it's known for a long time that aneuploidy or polyploidy is a real hallmark of cancers. And I'll show you some pictures when we get to the karyotyping bit in a little bit. But it's been known for 100 years now that if you look at the chromosome spread from a cancer cell, the genome is deranged. And then in the era of DNA sequencing, we found that along with that derangement is a variety of somatic mutations that we were talking about for colorectal cancers. Inherited germline mutations in cancers aren't really so common. I mean, it's thought that 5 to 10% of cancers probably are familial or inherited, but most of them are sporadic somatic mutations and not germline mutations. And finally, it's been observed that increases in the mutation rate, whether it's due to microsatellite instability or SIMP or radiation or chemical exposure, increases mutation rate, perhaps increases genomic instability, but certainly increases the frequency of cancers. So, as I alluded to, there are a variety of different types of chromosome instability or genomic instability in cancers, including chromosomal instability, what is called interchromosomal instability, which is a chromosome rearranging on itself. I think I grouped chromosomal instability here as loss of whole chromosomes or interchromosomal instability, it's chromosomal recombination. And we'll talk about interchromosomal recombination towards the end when we get to the paper. Microsatellite instability, which is this insertion and deletion of these CA repeats that we see in Lynch syndrome, for instance. And then more recently has emerged the idea of epigenetic instability. So modification of the histones or even the DNA can be heritable. And there's now some indication that dysregulation of methylation, for instance, can be tumor promoting. So a question that we can ponder, perhaps not address, perhaps it's a little too fundamental, is instability, is that a cause of the cancer or is it a consequence of the cancer? And actually the paper, at the end of the talk, we'll have a little bit of insight into that. So, this is a lecture course, of course, so there's a little bit of history. So there's some observations that led to the idea that genomic instability is important in cancer. So first, that tumor cells growing in culture are very unstable, but the instability is inherited. A little bit later, it was found that a normal mutation rate that one sees when you're just culturing cells is insufficient to produce transformation. And you need to have some kind of hypermutation going on to get transformation of cells. So if you looked at what was happening at the genome using CGH, it was observed in a little bit later that there were lots of amplifications and deletions. And so functionally why there are amplifications and deletions we'll hit on in just a minute, but it's important for cancer. And then we were talking about microsatellite instability, this idea that there's these di- or trinucleotide repeats that get expanded or contracted in the genome. So that was also found. And later, as cancer syndromes were characterized, it was observed that most of these inherited cancer syndromes actually had to do with genome stability. Whether it's HMPC in colorectal cancer, where mismatch repair genes are inactivated, the breast cancers where it's repair, checkpoints, ATM 53, or actual replication in blooms. And so the idea is that mutation, hypermutation, drives cancer. Yeah.
So specifically the one with the one cat line, you're talking about how those mutations are somatic. But with, for example, familial, would that be in the germline? Is that what you're talking
about? Yeah, so for BRCA in particular, there are recurring genetic mutations that are passed on in families, and this probably accounts for 5 or 10% of breast cancer, just like all other solid tumors. But BRCA is actually subject to somatic mutation too, sporadic mutations in the BRCA gene. And so, you know, over the years, as they've sequenced all these, primarily women, some men, but mostly women, they find that there's this familial recurrence and transmission, but that a large number of women also have, you know, sporadic hits. Is that, you know, due to bad luck or radiation or chemicals? We don't know, but we do see mutations all over the BRCA gene, not just in the recurring spots. You know, so it's one of these plots that looks like, you know, lots of little dots all the way along the gene with a couple of spikes up where the familials are. So, as I have kind of been talking about a little bit, so there are these different kinds of instability, chromosomal, microsatellite, mutations, and then epigenetic. And they're really different. So, you know, chromosomal instabilities, you know, it's really big changes that are happening due to, you know, replication problems or separation of the chromosomes problems. And these are usually lethal. The cells usually don't survive. And they apoptosis. But we can see these huge, and we've seen them for 100 years, these huge rearrangements using cytogenetic techniques. So, more recently, and really arising from Bert Vogelstein's work on colorectal cancer, the idea of microsatellite instability, where, as I was saying, you have these repetitive expansions and contractions of the genome at sensitive sites where you'll get dinucleotide and trinucleotide insertions, or what appears to be slippage on replication. And the reason that, you know, this is not an observable change in the genome by karyotyping, but it is quite observable using molecular techniques. And then, of course, mutations and small indels we only see by sequencing, and really only by NGS. By Sanger sequencing, you don't have enough throughput to tell what's a mistake versus what's a mutation. And now, in the last, you know, decade or 5 years, this idea of epigenetic instability is really starting to come to the fore. Okay, part two. So in your last lecture, I think you heard a lot about individual molecules controlling checkpoints and oncogenes and tumor suppressors and how those might contribute to cancer. And so, well, I want to try to spend a few minutes talking about how those might contribute to genomic instability. So, for the checkpoints, you know, for the mitotic control and chromosomal separation, you can see if the chromosomes aren't pulled, if there's multiple centromeres, they're going to pull the chromosomes apart in different ways. There could be desegregation. Which you can see here, you know, here you have chromosomes that were pulled in three separate ways by these three kinetic chromophores. Here you have four. Here you have leftover DNA that's going to be lost. So these are kind of big changes in the chromosomes. And there's a variety of genes that have been found to be associated with cancers that control chromosome segregation. You know, from the most common ones that we all think about, you know, RB or APC, to some more obscure ones, which even I don't think about very much. But there,
they're all apparently driving cancer because they're found recurrently in a variety of cancers. And so by causing alterations in the chromosomes, somehow they're affecting the tumorigenic change or transformation. So, as I was saying before, microsatellite instability can give you these dinucleotide repeats. I guess I did put trinucleotide repeats down here. Also trinucleotide repeats. And you can get expansion, or you can get slippage from this side to this side if during replication the polymerase has trouble with repeats. The interesting thing is that chromosome instability and microsatellite instability seem to be mutually exclusive. So if you have one, that's sufficient to drive cancer. If you have two, one would survive, that might be lethal. So if we look at the number of the amount of allelic loss in microsatellite unstable tumors is essentially none. But in chromosomally unstable tumors, of course, there's a lot of allele loss. And conversely, the number of mutations in the microsatellites is very high. But in the tumors harboring chromosomal instability, there's essentially very little mutation. So that tells you one is sufficient to drive. And since we don't have duals, it probably means that lethal. So another thing that controls chromosome stability is telomeres. So we all know telomeres are necessary to allow replication near the ends of chromosomes. And if we lose telomeres, we have a break in replication and senescence of the cell. But if we overexpress TERT, we can immortalize cells essentially. So when DNA end repair by telomerase goes bad, people have observed that you can get circularization of the chromosome. So because you don't have recycling of the telomeres on the end, reconstitution of the telomeres, you'll get non-homologous end joining and you'll get these circle formations. So oncogenes, in addition to causing cells to grow, also cause cells to replicate. And so having a lot of replication going on quickly tends to be an error-prone thing. And so by hyperactivating the replication paradigm, you can introduce error. And also, oncogenes are the object of amplification in the genome. And so if you amplify, an oncogene, those cells are going to grow better. And so there's a selection for hyperamplification, and we'll see that in a few minutes. Further, if you amplify checkpoints, then you won't have any restriction on growth control. And so in a big study from a couple of years ago, they analyzed what was happening with the copy number of a variety of genes that control replication, including origin and mini chromosome proteins, and you can see that they're all amplified up here, similar to what you see for MYC or for CD or for the cyclins over here. So controlling replication allows tumorigenesis, apparently. But if you amplify oncogenes, you're essentially putting the cell replication, the DNA replication apparatus into overdrive, and as I was saying, you get this high incidence of error. So in the, what it looks like, orange from here, red on my screen, are a variety of processes that can be affected by oncogene activation. You can get hyperactivity of the cell cycle restriction points, deregulation of the tumor suppressor genes, which can lead to overusage of origins, underusage or reusage, as shown in this picture. All of these, you know, are kind of drivers of this broad category of chromosome instability. And you can get this a variety of types of replication errors that also lead to bad chromosomes, unstable chromosomes, chromosome with loss or duplication. And so last week you heard about these DNA damage checkpoints, P53 or ATM, which normally lead to apoptosis when the DNA is damaged. But with their loss, you can have replication stress allowed chromosomal abnormalities, essentially. And so, when you have these pieces of DNA damaged, normally you get repair and re-replication, but if you have a variety of different kinds of stresses on the replication processes, you can get these inversions and translocations. And finally, about 5 years ago now, I guess 2011, 2016, yeah, exactly 5 years ago, a new kind of chromosomal instability was described, called chromothripsis, which instead of being massive translocations or small amplifications or deletions, there's this kind of wholesale rearrangement of the chromosome where it looks just like spaghetti. And so it's thought that there's some kind of chromosomal crisis, some kind of catastrophe that causes shattering of the chromosomes, and then DNA strand break repair or non-homologous end joining is causing these things to reassemble in this, you know, orientation agnostic kind of way. And you can see some of these fragments down here in this chromosome spread. And essentially by sequencing, they describe this. So as I was saying, you know, kind of orientation agnostic reassembly of the chromosomes. And you can characterize this, if I could push on this, when you sequence through, you can say, well, this was connected to this, and this was connected to this, and this was connected to this, and it's very complicated. I can't look at it and analyze it. All I can say is, wow, a really messed up chromosome. But as you'll see when we get to the paper in a few minutes, it's going to have a really profound functional consequence. So in addition to things being joined back in the wrong way, there's frequently a lot of loss, and here you can see four blocks got lost, but as we'll see later, you can lose a lot more than four blocks. So finally, just a few words about techniques of looking at what's happening with genome instability, genome integrity, chromosomal instability. So as I was saying before, that you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at these based on the size of the damage that we're detecting. So historically, it was spreading out the chromosomes on a glass slide and putting some Gemsa stain on. Then lately, you know, so there's some fluorescent markers for the karyotype, CGH, some SNP arrays, and now, you know, high throughput sequencing and PCRs for repeats. So let's just take a look at what those look like, because we're going to look at them in this paper in a minute. So, as I said before, you know, 100 years ago, probably about exactly 100 years ago, people started spreading chromosomes out, popping the cells, spreading the chromosomes out, and the mitotic figures, you could observe the chromosomes, and you could stain them with Gemsa and take a picture of them and cut out the picture, and you could reassemble a picture like this, and this is what used to happen in cytogenetics labs all around the world. And you can see kind of one of the more common chromosome defects or genomic instability paradigms, which is trisomy here. So each one of these chromosomes, instead of being in pairs, is in triplets all the way through this chromosome, or through this cell's chromosome retinue. And so then, maybe 20 years ago now, people developed fluorescent stains for the different chromosomes, made it much easier to see any defects. And here you can see that part of chromosome X has been swapped with part of chromosome 19 here. Otherwise, this is a normal individual. And here you can see that the myriad of chromosome instability and translocations and inversions that happen in cancer, where you have some chromosome duplication, this aneuploidy, some loss, you can see that, and then some translocation with other chromosomes, 3, 14, 16, X, it's a mess, this cancer cell. And so we can look at individual genes too. If, for instance, we want to examine oncogene amplification. So here you can see that they've used a control probe, which you see two copies of, but you see that there's three copies of this other gene, which whose identity I can't remember. And finally, people have started doing, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, oligonucleotide arrays and then hybridizing the chromosomes onto those arrays, and you can then tell about the frequency of the DNA from each chromosome, and you can map it out, and you can see if you map along the length of the chromosome, if you map oligonucleotides along the length of the chromosome, you get increasing or decreasing amounts of DNA hybridizing to that, and you can construct a virtual karyotype, so instead of actually looking at it down a microscope, you can do this all by reconstructing from the array the depth of sequencing, and you can see gains over here, I think in blue on this one, and losses, areas where signal was over or underrepresented relative to a control cell. And finally, you know, the modern era, the last 10 years now, the best way, the most powerful way we have up to this point to analyze instability is to sequence whole genomes. And so frequently we talk about doing RNA-seq or exome-seq. Whole genome-seq is a whole other ball of wax. There's a lot more. There's 3 billion base pairs, not 300 million or 30 million that you get in an exome. And so frequently people don't sequence to the depth that you need to define the myriad of alterations, and sometimes difficult to reconstruct the larger changes by NGS, particularly if you're just doing, you know, 50 base pair or 100 base pair paired end reads. Perhaps with the newer sequencing technologies like PacBio or something where you can do long stretches, you'll be able to have a better ability to reconstruct, but people are still trying to make it work. And so I think, you know, I forgot to talk about microsatellites. So microsatellites were originally described as these CA repeat insertions or deletions, and you can see insertions here. So this is the normal, and this is the tumor. You see that this is an orbit inserted, and this is deleted due to probably polymerase slippage. Nowadays, we do it on a sequencer, not on a gel, and you can see again the same thing, some insertions. Can we see some deletions? Yeah, just insertions. So mismatch repair. Well, I don't even know what I want to say about seq. I guess this isn't. So mismatch repair can produce instability. If it's not corrected, that's not really a very interesting slide. But if you examine what's happening in cancer genomes over the last 10 years, as more and more have been sequenced, we see that there's that, you know, perhaps Vogelstein 25 years ago now wasn't so far off in saying that there were these four genes that needed to be hit in sequence in order to get tumors. In fact, after sequencing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cases of cancer of, you know, a variety of different types, people are finding that there's a very limited subset of genes that are mutated in cancers. And so from this study, they found, 200 genes. The average tumor had 100 mutations. And those are essentially all the genes that are responsible for cancer in these two cancer types. That pattern applies to most solid tumors. There's really only a few hundred genes that are altered in tumors. Most of those recurrent genes are driver mutations. There's a lot of passenger mutations, particularly if you're talking about looking at the whole genome. There's a lot of SNVs that we don't know how to interpret because they're low frequency and we haven't seen other tumors. And so we generally think of those as variants of unknown significance, but probably not drivers. We only think that we see drivers when they reappear. So then there's the question back to this idea of colon cancer and other solid tumors, maybe, as we'll get to in a minute, is when does genomic instability cause progression from there just being a few mutations to there being a transformation event from an adenoma, for instance, to an adenocarcinoma? Is it something that happens relatively early and then additional mutations accumulate? So do we have aneuploidy and then mutations on top of the aneuploidy, or do we have mutations and then aneuploidy? Kind of the question. So this paper that came out last week by this huge group of people, none of whom I know, but they did a really amazing bioinformatics job. Pancreatic cancer is particularly aggressive and kind of just appears in patients primarily at a metastatic state. And it's known to be highly unstable genomically. So this group sequenced 100 whole genomes or 100 tumors and whole genomes from those tumors. And in addition, from individual tumors, they purified sampling of cells from individual tumors or from metastases, and they sequenced the whole genome, not just the exome, and they tried to reconstruct what was happening in the evolution of the tumors. And so they developed a tool that allowed them to look at the ploidy of the tumor cells, and what they found was that about half of the tumors were diploid, but half of them actually showed a lot of aneuploidy. And here you can see that this tumor is trapped triploid or quadriploid. Interestingly, the P53 or SMAD, which drives tumorigenesis, seems to be lost in this. Where the parent copy number of those is low. And you can see that if you look at this fish, where the control CP17 is here. This one has two copies of P53, as is predicted by their tool, and one copy of SMAD4 is predicted here. And in the diploid, they see the same sort of correspondence where they see one copy of each and one on fish. So that's validating their ploidy measures. And they draw the conclusion that mutations in, for instance, P53 or SMAD probably happen before the aneuploidy event, because when the chromosome is duplicated, you'd expect two. And then these tumor suppressors, there's a loss of heterozygosity, so you fall back to one. So, actually, we've lost the bottom of our slide here. That was a bad shot. So they conclude that the copy number variations, the ploidy changes of the tumor cells, the copy number variations are occurring post-ploidy. And so they looked at what was happening in these tumors, in this huge variety of tumors, and they found that that copy number losses and copy number gains were happening after aneuploidy. We lost the slide. They also looked at changes that were happening that weren't apparently driving cancer, just synonymous mutations in a variety of genes, and they found that those happened just as much before cancer events as before polyploidy as after polyploidy. And so then they used a tool to study the chromothripsis, which they were able to observe in these pancreatic cancers, and they found that most of the copy number alterations were happening after a single event of chromothripsis. So the chromosome blew up, and after that it became aneuploid. Oh, all of my things got shrunk on this computer. So then they wanted to figure out how was the tumor evolving in the patient. And so they looked at what was happening in... I can't believe we lost all these things. We lost it all. We'll see what we get. Well, we lost some of our PowerPoint. Back to PC world. It's a bad world. So they looked at metastases from a variety of different sites in this patient, this with pancreatic cancer, and they found the same pattern of amplification. So here is MYC, here in the heart, here in the lung, here in the lung, here in the lymph node, and actually in the original figure there's four more because they looked at eight sites. So they looked at the primary site, a couple of different lymph node sites, adrenal gland, diaphragm, somewhere else. And they all had the same MYC amplification, which means that the MYC amplification happened before tumorigenesis, before the tumor spread from the primary across the patient. And so this tells us a little bit about when the amplification was occurring. Apparently before, there was some event that happened before the spread that allowed the spread to happen. And so... here you can see that a little bit better. So here are these MYC amplifications in all these different metastasis sites. And here's the ploidy change in all these different metastasis sites. And what you can see is that the ploidy change is essentially identical between all of these different sites, as is the amplification. So somehow a combination of amplification and ploidy change allowed the tumor to spread, allowed tumor genesis to occur, allowed progression. So... this is what I just said. The Mets all have the same ploidy. And further, they were able to look at this chromothripsis using this tool, which is a little difficult to understand. But essentially, it's a map of the inversions and duplications. And they found that the metastases also had the same pattern of chromothripsis. And that the... copy number variations in both in ploidy and in the oncogenes were mostly clonal throughout this metastasis set, and so it was likely a late event. And so they actually did whole genome sequencing. They took a pancreas and essentially disaggregated it, and they got single cells of normal pancreas, of pre-neoplastic or in situ neoplasia in the pancreas, in these purple ones here, and then a variety of tumor cells. And then they made an evolutionary tree, and they found that, in fact, most of the tumor was clonal and derived from just a single massive event, apparently. And that suggested that it was that this progression to tumor to becoming a tumor was a late event that was happening. There wasn't a lot of mutation happening early that led up to this, but it was an explosion, and this paper suggested it's this chromosynthetic event. So rather than the you know, Vogelstein-esque model of pancreatic cancer progression of RAS, CDK, P53, and SMAD that allows this kind of stepwise progression of the tumor, that in fact, there's a lot of different things happening all at the same time. So they seem to think that SMAD, P53, are getting mutated in all of these tumors late. So somehow there's this massive rearrangement that's going on. So it's not, you know, this is the kind of Vogelstein-esque model of one mutation leading to a second, leading to a third. And these out-competing each other, and you have these clonal expansions. Instead, you have this, perhaps an early driver mutation, a RAS mutation, and then all of a sudden an explosion of changes. And so they say that they describe this amplification event that happens in the area of CDK2, where you have an amplification, multifold amplification here. And then you have this rearrangement of the genome that they attribute to this kind of chromosynthetic event with this massive amount of reassortment of the chromosomes. And so none of these slides came out well. I'm sorry. This is the end of the slides, though, which is good news. So you should look at the paper. It's a little bit difficult to read, but it's actually very instructive and kind of brings this idea of chromosome instability together. I'm sorry that the PowerPoint messed up, and I couldn't show you the primary data, but you can look through it and you can see the primary data is pretty impressive in terms of the amount of work that they did. And their insight into the meaning of the molecular changes that they were seeing allows them to predict. Actually, there is a slide that I'd really like to see, which is not going to show up. Yeah. Nope, it's not going to show up. So allows them to offer some insight onto whether you have this kind of gradual accumulation of mutations that drive the tumor, or whether you have, you know, an enabling mutation like RAS here for pancreatic cancer, and then this flood of mutation. So in the paper, they actually nicely point out that this chromostripsis causes a flood of mutation, essentially, that there's mutation and loss of the tumor suppressors, that there's amplification of the oncogenes, and it's a very ordered event, and it all happens actually very, very late in the stage of pancreatic neoplastic development, I guess you'd say. So their data really nicely shows this kind of, that the chymotrypsis happens here, the chromosomes get lost, and the drivers get amplified, and soon thereafter, which is figure 2D, you have this blossoming of metastases, of tumor genesis, essentially. And so by blowing up the chromosome, the pre-neoplastic lesion is suddenly enabled to spread outside of the pancreas, and we all know that pancreatic cancer is a short duration, and that's why, because a pre-neoplastic lesion can't essentially be detected. There's no tumor marker for pancreatic cancer, like PSA for prostate cancer. So you just have this essentially indolent lesion sitting there, and all of a sudden the chromosomes blow up and get duplicated, and so you have duplication of the oncogenes, loss of the tumor suppressors, and the pancreatic cancer spreads beyond all belief, both molecularly and in terms of tumor biology, unfortunately. So quite a good paper. It's quite interesting to think about the evolution of cancer. And that's essentially it. Yeah. So again, I apologize for the bad PowerPoint loss of the data, but I encourage you to look at the paper. Any questions? The mutation in RAS allows the cell to divide essentially the oncogene and cause it to hyperactivate the pathways of the normally remembered cellular path, allowing the cell to continue to cooperate. Not as maybe the super high rate that a real lab causes the cell to proliferate, but it's still a hyper proliferation and allows the cell to have to keep surrounding itself. So it has one piece of because it has this already hyperproliferating trigger for cells, when this happens, then suddenly you have this very overly competitive cell.
What would such damage, like this catastrophic event, like make the cell not viable?
Probably. If you think like an evolutionary biology, you would say that one in a million of these events would be. But if you have a hyperproliferating pre-neoplastic cell, then you have millions of cells in your pancreas that are susceptible for it. And so if one of these catastrophic events happens to not have the tumor suppressor, and they're actually very nicely detailed in the paper. There were cases of tumor suppressors that were not that, and oncogenes that are very amplified. But by having this random event that occurs in 10^-6, or 10^-9, I don't know what it is, but in an environment that's already pro-growth.
Gracias.